days of the pandemic were some of the first to lose their lives on the front line treating those who had contracted the disease.
The lethal effects of COVID resulting in deaths and black and ethnic minority peoples. And that's hugely disproportionate for African descent peoples within that overall black and ethnic minority category. And yet this government has routinely refused to recognise that the consequence of institutionalised racism, enforced poverty, the ethnic pay gap that pushes black and ethnic minority workers into the lowest paid public sector, public facing sector jobs has resulted in them being overexposed to the vulnerability of COVID.
As well as concerns about structural inequalities impacting COVID, some have also raised concerns about the potential of some medical conditions within BAME communities being impacted by COVID.
There have been papers in the British Medical Journal alerting to the fact that certain blood pressure and diabetes medications do seem to cause, when there is an infection already, it's more likely to escalate into the disastrous lung problems that cause sudden death. So I know that there is a difference between Indigenous and BAME communities in this country as regards those problems.
Irrespective of continued debates over health issues within BAME communities, the impact of COVID on those communities due to existing structural inequality is to many undeniable.
We've seen with Belly Malinga and others here in the United Kingdom, a rail worker who was spat upon who later died of COVID, and the doctors overwhelmingly Asian and African, the nurses overwhelmingly African and Asian that have died as a consequence of COVID being brutally ignored by this government, who are now suggesting that it's down to black people and Asian people's lifestyles why they are more vulnerable to COVID rather than the brutal realities of institutionalised racism.
As the effects of COVID continue to grip the nation, many people remain deeply concerned about the devastating impact of COVID on some of the country's most marginalised communities.
Although the debate continues, many medical experts believe that COVID-19 disproportionately affects BAME communities already dealing with inequalities within the health service, leading many to ask the question, what do decision makers intend to do about those inequalities? Richard Sudam, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Former Maltese Prime Minister Joseph Muscat is facing a public inquiry into the murder of journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. She was killed in a bomb blast near her home in 2017. Activists and the political opposition say Muscat protected people linked to the murder. Muscat, who stepped down as Prime Minister in January this year, denies any wrongdoing. The former PM has close ties to several people under criminal investigation for Galizia's murder. The victim was an acclaimed investigative reporter who made a career exposing rampant corruption, cronyism, nepotism, and organized crime in Maltese politics. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said he hoped France would get rid of what he called the Macron trouble very soon. Speaking to reporters, the president described the French leader as a burden on France, who has led the nation into a very dangerous period. The Turkish leader's comments come just a day after France announced it would be launching a massive and unprecedented attack on 76 mosques deemed to be extremist by the government's controversial definition of Islamic extremism. Erdogan has previously stated that his French counterpart needed a mental check for his separatist attitudes on Muslims. Thousands of Armenians have taken to the capital Yerevan, blocking major roads and bringing traffic to a standstill in the latest round of demonstrations to hit the country. They're calling for the resignation of the Prime Minister Nicole Pashinyan over a ceasefire deal they say prematurely locked in Azeri territorial gains in the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh last month. The PM says the deal was a disaster, but it staved off a large-scale defeat. Despite a coalition of 17 opposition parties naming a potential caretaker prime minister to replace him, Pashinyan is refusing to step down, saying he is now responsible for ensuring national security and stabilizing Armenia. As Brexit negotiations reach their conclusion, ministers in the UK and leaders throughout the EU will be keen to unpick all the other details, as the threat of no deal remains a real possibility. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, some in the EU may in fact favor a no-deal scenario.
Good morning.
Open up.
A deal is imminent. These are the latest murmurings to leak from the Brexit negotiations between the United Kingdom and the European Union. As we approach the 11th hour, differences remain, but the reality of the circumstances are becoming ever clearer.
We are negotiating, and of course I follow closely the process of negotiation, but we will see in the next hours or in the next days what will be on the table, and we will need to assess the situation. And this will be a question at the end of the negotiation. We need to decide, the member states, they will need to decide. Like the British side, we will need to say yes or no, and the member states will say yes or no.
If progress is made, all 27 member states have to agree and ratify the deal in the European Parliament. France, however, have been very vocal. If the deal does not suit them, they will veto the agreement and send both sides into a no-deal outcome.
France is committed to our interests. We need to prepare ourselves for a no-deal, meaning that on December 31st, we would no longer have free movement and free access to the British market, and vice versa. But that's not what we desire. Negotiations are continuing as we speak, but I also want to tell our fishermen, our companies and our citizens we will not accept a bad deal. If the deal does not correspond with our interests, we will oppose it.
While many see such sentiments as negotiating tactics, some believe France actually wants a no-deal outcome. Economically, they will be affected, but it will be the UK that will feel the impact the hardest. France still has free trade with Europe and all nations that have trade agreements with the Union. The UK, however, will be limited to World Trade Organization tariffs. In this way, a no-deal outcome gives France the opportunity to fill the void left by the UK, who will find themselves increasingly isolated. A no-deal can also lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom. This will significantly impact the global standing of Westminster, who have recently been overtaken by India in the global order of world economies. Economic forecasts put the UK at the bottom of the G7, with the pandemic having impacted the UK economy more than its neighbours. In this vein, a deal that will protect jobs and livelihoods is now more vital than sentiment and ideology.
Coming up in this segment, another example of Israeli soldiers committing violence against Palestinians and getting away with it. The case of a Palestinian boy shot in the eye with a rubber bullet in February. Let's bring in Robert Enlikesh with all the latest details. Robert.
Well, before we get into this, an update from the West Bank. A Palestinian 12-year-old child has just been shot and killed. That's another update on their violence that they're using against Palestinians. This case that we're looking at here was actually thrown out of an Israeli court when it was investigated. The then 8-year-old boy, Malik Issa, was shot in the head by an Israeli police officer in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. There were multiple eyewitnesses to this. There was an investigation into the evidence of what he was struck with. However, the Israeli forces claimed that they had shot at a wall and not shot at the child. Of course, again, this runs contrary to all the claims of the eyewitnesses, but because the eyewitnesses are Palestinian, they're thrown out. And this case was thrown out of court, not investigating the Israelis who shot this innocent, now 9-year-old boy. His parents came out with a statement saying there is no justice in this world. So unfortunately, another case of Israel yet again getting away with its terrorist attacks on children.
There is no justice in this world, as you say, quoting Malik Issa's family. How has social media reacted to this story?
first comment we have here is from a Twitter account called Princess Warrior, who says, recent news on the Palestinian child medic Asa, 9 years old, who was shot in the eye by an Israeli terrorist. He was with his two younger sisters when this happened, and where's the terrorist shooter? Roaming around in all freedom, completely unpunished, face with symbols over mouth. BDS, ICC for Israel as the two hashtags there. We got another one here as well from an account called Illuminati Killer, who says, this is what infuriates me. Meanwhile, Washington makes Israel look like the good guys. Nothing to see here, just pay your taxes and don't ask where that money's going or what it's for.
And Robert, these killings are happening quite regularly. I think it was the day before yesterday, was it? We reported on the other young man who was shot by the Israeli soldiers, and they denied that they had done that.
Absolutely. These sort of denials come frequently after their terrorist attacks on innocent Palestinian civilians. Of course, the attack that we reported on a few days ago was in Jerusalem al-Quds. This attack here was today, which just occurred, was on a 12-year-old Palestinian named Ali. He was shot in the stomach with live ammunition. And again, no one is going to have to pay for this. No one's going to go to prison for this. I can guarantee you that. And unfortunately, the case that we're looking at here as well of Malik, he's lost his eye, and no one's going to pay for that either.
No one's going to pay for it. And of course, you're going to keep us updated on that breaking story of the Palestinian, young Palestinian shot dead in the past hour or so. Let's move on to your second story. The U.S. has accused China of being the greatest threat to democracy and freedom. And that, of course, comes 2 months after China accused the U.S. of being the greatest threat to global strategic security and stability. Fill us in.
Well, China's claim actually has a little bit of truth to that, whereas the United States just coming with its traditional my freedoms, my liberty, and all the rest of it, which it, you know, constantly goes around the world carrying the flag and the banner of freedom and liberty and of being, you know, operating as a democracy, yet it acts with complete impunity around the world, sanctions countries, commits war crimes, military coups, is the only country to actually have used a nuclear weapon on innocent civilians in the cases of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And it goes around the world trying to lecture other countries. What we're seeing here is the development into a new Cold War. The United States is using the likes of Australia, for instance, as its sort of attack dog, especially in the South China Sea as well. And on top of that, what we're seeing is this sort of developing situation where the United States is attempting to isolate China. So it will be interesting to see what they do when Joe Biden comes in, whether he'll take the same line as Trump, he'll pursue a trade war with China, or whether he's going to try and engage with China, because China has built its place on this earth with diplomacy, not with bullets. Unfortunately, the United States of America, since World War II, has been doing all of its diplomacy with bullets and bombs rather than trade relationships.
And we may want to throw into the mix the Blackwater security firm and what they did in Afghanistan, and of course the scandal at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Bring us the online reaction to this briefly.
First comment we have here says the U.S. has the cheek to call China the biggest threat to freedom, lol. Says the country currently engaged in so many wars for corporate profit that we no longer can count. Another one here as well from a user called Tom, who says, here's what the title of this story should really read. U.S. mad at China, so it blames it of trying to do some of the bad things the U.S. already does. The morons could read an Onion piece on this and still think it's true. Quoting my freedoms, hashtag war.
My freedom, my freedoms. I think that's how it should be read. All right, Robert in Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you very much. And that does it for this broadcast from London. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense.
Another point about the Sacred Defense is that it familiarized us with the embellished nature and reality of the Western civilization. Of course, because the Iranian nation had previously come to harm at the hands of Westerners, the English in one way and the Americans in another way, they were aware of their nature to some extent, but not as much as what they learned about Westerners in the Sacred Defense. Of course, the Iranian nation had witnessed Western governments' hostility and treachery in many incidents, such as the occupation of parts of the country after World War I and World War II, and the English's mischief and malice in the South. In Bushehr, in Persian Gulf areas, on the issue of the war between Iran and some other powers, and also on the issue of Afghanistan. They had witnessed the treachery of Western governments, but not as much as what they saw in the Sacred Defense era.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever wanna need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Sayyidul Akwani, Huwal Mannan.
What was seen during the sacred defense era was not less, if not more, than what we saw in Westerners throughout the course of many years. It either equals or even exceeds it. The West was against us with its two faces. Not only the capitalist West, but also the communist West. This is because communism is also one of the products of the West. It was against us with its two facets. England, France, Germany, and even Yugoslavia, which was a country in the Eastern Bloc, moved against us. As for the Soviet Union, it was clear. In other words, all Westerners had deprived us of the slightest resources and weapons. They really deprived us of the slightest resources. We had nothing coming from the outside. We did not even have light weapons and small ammunition.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The debate.
Last month, U.S. President Donald Trump issued an executive order prohibiting U.S. investments into a list of Chinese companies that Washington said were owned or controlled by the Chinese military. Now, the Trump administration will be adding China's top chipmaker and an oil and gas producer to that list as well. Beijing has slammed the move, saying that it firmly opposes Washington's wanton oppression of Chinese companies. This comes as the U.S. government is just one step away from enacting a law that could kick several Chinese firms off Wall Street. The U.S. Congress passed the bill on Wednesday, which could get signed into law quickly by President Donald Trump as it was approved by the Republican-controlled Senate back in May.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has targeted more Chinese companies, accusing them of having ties with the country's military. China's top chipmaker, SMIC, and oil giant China National Offshore Oil Corporation, as well as two other firms, have been added to the so-called blacklist of the U.S. Defense Department. This comes amid escalating tensions between the world's two top economies on multiple fronts. China has slammed the move, saying it firmly opposes what it calls Washington's wanton oppression of Chinese companies. Beijing says the measure will severely harm America's interest and image. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman also urged Washington to, quote, stop abusing its national power and national security concepts to surpass foreign companies. Over the past weeks, several Chinese companies have been blacklisted under an executive order signed by Trump.
Washington and Beijing have been at loggerheads over a host of issues ranging from trade, technology, security, human rights to COVID-19 that all intensified when Trump took office in 2017 with his administration launching a trade war with China, leading to a tit-for-tat tariffs measures. Since then, key Chinese industries, including telecoms giants Huawei and ZTE, as well as several social media apps, have also been targeted under different pretexts. Washington has also used the issues of Hong Kong and Taiwan to put more pressure on China. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. So why is the Trump administration keen on infuriating China? It seems the expanded blacklist is part of a bid to cement Trump's tough-on-China legacy before Democratic President-elect Joe Biden takes office on January the 20th.
I think this is definitely a part of a larger effort against China. The United States has to find another way of undermining China. Obviously, militarily, taking on China is a near impossible task. It would not be possible. The foot soldiers alone to occupy China just simply do not exist.
Relations between the world's two top economies have sunken to the lowest level since Trump's arrival in the White House. Just recently, even the Democrat-led House of Representatives passed a law to delist Chinese companies from stock exchange if they do not fully comply with the U.S. auditing rules, thus giving Trump one more tool to threaten Beijing before leaving office. But will Trump be able to inflict beyond repair damage to the Sino-U.S. relationship remains to be seen.
Joining us on this debate, we have political analyst Michael Lane joining us from Washington, D.C. Also from the Executive Intelligence Review, we have Michael Billington joining us from Hamilton. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Lane in Washington. The Pentagon, as we know, added four more Chinese companies to a list of firms it says are owned or controlled by China's military, exposing them to potential sanctions by the U.S. What is this list intended to do?
This list is intended to really cut back dramatically on what the U.S. perceives is a very, very widespread and very aggressive move on China's part to spy on the United States. I mean, we have 100,000 students here in the United States from China studying, and the generally accepted number is that 95,000 out of that 100,000 students are actually agents of the Chinese government and report intelligence back to the government. There is a widespread belief in the Trump administration that these companies are all, if not controlled by, certainly influenced by and cooperative with the Chinese military. And so therefore, in any economic relationships that they have with the United States or United States companies, they will immediately take any useful information, be it military intelligence or product intelligence or trade secrets or anything else, and funnel that back to the Chinese military and the Chinese government. Donald Trump made no mistake about the fact that he was going to deal with China a different way when he became president. We started our relationship with China back in the Nixon administration. From Nixon through Obama, it was widely believed and widely practiced that the more you engaged with your adversary, the more likely you were to get along with them and that everything was just going to be fabulous. Donald Trump had a different point of view. He thought the Chinese were eating America's lunch. And so he took a confrontational, adversarial style with them. It's been going on for 4 years. Some of the wins that Trump has had, such as new trade deals, have worked out very, very well for the United States. Others are still pending, and it remains to be seen what will happen when Donald Trump leaves office and his successor comes in.
Mike Billington, what is at the heart of this dispute, and why is the Trump administration continuing to pick a fight with China, even on his way out?
Well, let me say that the view expressed by Mike Lane there, that is the view of the British and American intelligence community, and that's the way in which they've orchestrated this anti-China McCarthyite witch hunt over these last few years. But it's extremely important for people to reflect on the fact that while Trump was absolutely committed to ending the wild trade deficit, and that's why he took on the trade issue, that he nonetheless invited Xi Jinping to the U.S. He went to China. He repeatedly described Xi Jinping as one of the great leaders of a great nation. And until the COVID thing hit, when he initially correctly identified the greatest problem here being the 30-year takedown of our health system, which left us virtually helpless against this mess, he was convinced by the lunatics around him, people like Pompeo, Navarro, and Esper, whom he's now fired. But nonetheless, these were the people running the Pompeo-McCarthyite attack on China, throwing Chinese-American scientists out of their jobs, deporting them, shutting down the Confucius Institutes, accusing as your other guest said, which of course is a bit absurd, that 95% of the students here were actually communist agents spying on us and so on. This has been done against Chinese American scientists who were some of our leading cancer and Parkinson's research people. That's how insane this McCarthyism was done. But Trump, until March approximately or May, refused to go along or say any of the garbage that's peddled by the Pompeo networks about China. He never goes after the lie that there's a million Muslims locked up in Xinjiang. He didn't go after Hong Kong for somehow destroying the sovereignty of autonomy of Hong Kong. That was all the Pompeo crowd. And Trump finally gave in, unfortunately, to the idea that he had to blame somebody for both the pandemic and the economic breakdown that ensued, and started going after China. But even so, he does not repeat the stories that are peddled by Pompeo and Navarro and so on. And it's my strong sense that if he succeeds in defeating this massive vote fraud, this attempt to steal the election on behalf of the lunatics in the Democratic Party who have been for 4 years trying to throw Trump out of office, along with the Republican neocons who were working hand in hand with them, who are now trying to steal it through this massive vote fraud, which luckily is Trump is standing up and it's now being exposed. But if you have Biden, who's, as people know, early stages of senility, who has openly said in an interview with Thomas Friedman at the New York Times, the fake news New York Times, openly said that if he comes in, that Trump, who had not kissed the of the British and our so-called allies, he will rebuild our allies in order to be able to stand up together as an international coalition of the willing against China. So you're not going to see some, go back to the old days type of situation. You're dealing here with the British American intelligence networks that ran Russiagate and the coup attempt against Trump,
right,
who are running the vote fraud, preparing for a confrontation with both Russia and China, preparing to go back to war in Syria, as Biden and his new Secretary of State Blinken are committed to. They said the only mistake Obama made was that he didn't go into full-scale war to overthrow Assad the way he did with Gaddafi.
Okay,
so we're looking at the potential for war, and I think it's wrong to say that this won't go into war because we can't occupy China. The point of these wars, these regime change colonial-style wars, is to destroy countries that don't follow the dictate.
Okay, let's bring in Michael Lane once again on the... Sorry, Mr. Billington. Michael Lane in Washington. Let's talk about this, the law that was the U.S. government, as we know, is just one step away from enacting a law that could kick several Chinese firms off of Wall Street, further escalating the tensions between Washington and Beijing. That legislation won unanimous backing in the Senate earlier this year, meaning it only needs President Donald Trump's signature. to become law. I want you to break that down for us and also have this in mind. Why does Wall Street money keep pushing into China despite the risk? A record $212 billion of increased exposure to Chinese bonds and equities this year alone.
Well, Wall Street doesn't have a particular ideology or even a political philosophy that it follows. It follows the almighty dollar. And as long as it perceives that the risk is worth taking to make these investments, capital investments in China, and that they will get their return on investment, and returns on investment have been generally pretty attractive as the economy in China over the last decades has been expanding at rates faster than any other part of the world, they will continue to make those investments. But I think that what this legislation does is allows the president, and he will sign it, I believe, it will then allow him to order the delisting of some Chinese economic entities, companies, corporations, from Wall Street, so that they would not have the advantages of being traded on the New York exchanges. That will create difficulties for them, and it will also put them on a couple different lists here in the United States, where it will make it much more difficult for organizations like the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security and other things that might typically do business with them, source some of their products, et cetera. It will make it harder for them to do business with the federal government and therefore almost impossible for them to do business in America. It is the Congress's belief, because they passed this, as you pointed out, a unanimous vote in the Senate, and I think it is Trump's belief as well, that these corporations are using their power, their influence, and particularly their access to get trade secrets, to get economic secrets, and to get military secrets, technology secrets particularly, that help them advance the ball with no particular effort on their own other than stealing it from the United States. Trump believes that, I think, and he wants to stop it. My colleague may have a different perspective on that.
Mr. Billington, we'd like to get your perspective also. Here's another issue. The top U.S. intelligence official, John Ratcliffe, he has labeled China the biggest threat to democracy and freedom worldwide since the Second World War, saying that China was bent on global domination. His comments sounded something like this. The intelligence is clear. Beijing intends to dominate the U.S. and the rest of the planet economically, militarily, and technologically. That's the clearest example of the pot calling the kettle black, if I've ever heard one.
I agree with you 100%. The point is, the intent of the British, the neocons, and the Democrats in the U.S. Has nothing to do with China trying to take over the world. It's that their power over the entire world is on the brink of totally blowing up. The Western financial system is now a bubble unprecedented in history. It's going to blow. They can't just keep printing money. They're even now talking about basically shutting down commercial banking and allowing federal central banks run the economy through digital currencies, which would literally take the power over the economy away from elected governments and put it in the hands of these New York, London bankers. Look, the opposition to this, and again, I emphasize that Trump himself has not gone along with the crazy things that are said about this, but the real opposition is coming from governors and the states. There's a meeting coming up on the 7th of four former governors, including very prominent governors. This includes Huntsman, who was the ambassador to China, Gary Locke, Washington governor, who was an ambassador to China, and others, Rick Snyder. These people know that it was the work with China on basically the kind of Belt and Road type development projects that pulled America out of the mess we'd been in coming out of the 2008 financial breakdown crisis. I mean, while Wall Street did nothing but print money but refused to invest in the real economy, the Chinese were investing in the real economy, building infrastructure, agricultural development, in the United States as well as around the world with the Belt and Road program. What they're concerned about is losing the power, especially over the developing sector nations, who for the first time in modern history, since the beginning of colonialism, really, for the first time have a reason to be optimistic that they can take their impoverished countries that have been kept backwards by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the British intelligence and financial networks, who are now turning to China for a very real reason, not because China's going to dominate them with their... China doesn't impose their political system on countries the way we try to with so-called project democracy. Go to war with them if they don't accept our version of democracy, the kind of democracy you see in Iraq and Libya. You know, what a joke. So, I mean, here's the situation where you have a threat in the view of the imperial crowd around China and the United States that their ability to loot the third world, to get the resources they want at cheap prices, using cheap labor, that's being threatened by the fact that China, which is now supported by literally over 100 nations, are saying, no, we're going to do what America did in the first place, which is to build infrastructure, break free of the control of the financial interests, and actually build real economies, which is the logjam that stops these poor countries from moving forward, building the rail systems, the power systems, real basic infrastructure. And for this, the crowd around Trump, as well as in the Democrats, this is the imperial crowd which brought our own nation into ruin.
Sure, Mr. Billington, I'm sorry to jump in there. We're pressed for time. I want to get a last comment in from Mr. Lane. Mr. Lane, in under 30 seconds, please. Earlier in the year, the U.S. Defense Department said it was increasingly focused on China as a threat to the Indo-Pacific region and globally as well by undermining international order and aggressive modernization of its People's Liberation Army. Washington really is worried about China's military modernization, isn't it?
Yes, it is, quite worried. You know, the development particularly of the Chinese Navy, you know, which is creating the ability to dominate the South China Sea and threaten all United States allied relationships there, as well as to project force forward, is very disconcerting to the Pentagon and to the United States government, the White House. I would continue to look at that as being a an item of concern for the Biden administration, but I don't think they'll place as much action and adversarial tit-for-tat with China as the Trump administration does.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Allow me to thank my guest, Mr. Michael Lane, political analyst, joining us from Washington, D.C. Also thanks to Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Hamilton. Also, special thanks to you, Art, for staying with us on this debate.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
sparked by a new bill that would make publishing photos of police illegal, and a viral video soon after that shows French police brutally beating a black man, it appears that France may be headed for its own George Floyd moment, says Alan McLeod, writer in an article published under the heading, France's new security law may have just sparked a George Floyd moment. Stay tuned for the details, please. Award-winning Syrian photographer Amir Al-Halbi lies dazed on the ground. His head is heavily bruised and bandaged. Blood covers his face, arms, and much of his body. Lengths of cotton wool have been stuffed up his broken nose, giving him an almost comical appearance. Al-Halbi has been badly beaten by French police. But this is Paris, where he was covering ironically huge nationwide protest against police brutality this weekend. Perhaps even more concerning is that new laws pushed through by the government of Emmanuel Macron and passed by France's National Assembly, akin to the U.S. House of Representatives, mean that sharing images of Al-Halbi or other victims of police brutality might soon be considered illegal. Article 24 of the France's new national security bill, which now only needs to be ratified by the Senate, specifically outlaws the publishing and dissemination of images of police that undermine their physical or psychological integrity and is punishable with a fine of up to 45,000 euros and up to 1 year in jail. The bill specifically states that filming police in such a manner would be against the law, but questions have been raised about how liberally authorities would interpret a nebulous language of the new edict is interpreted. Media unions and human rights groups warn that it could prevent journalists from documenting police abuses. The National Assembly's decision to approve the law last week sparked large protests in many major cities around France, including Bordeaux, Lille, Montpellier, and Nantes. However, an incident caught on camera recently threw large amounts of fuel on the fire of resentment, drastically increasing the demonstration size and intensity. Images from mobile phones and closed-circuit television showed an unprovoked police attack on a young black music producer at his place of work. A group of four officers can be seen chasing after Michel Zecler, following him from outside into his studio, where they kick, punch, and beat him with truncheons. Zecler also alleges they shouted racial abuse while they assailed him. Before the videos went viral on social media, the officers testified that Zecler had in fact attacked them and was resisting arrest. The officers have now been charged with deliberate violence and with falsifying statements. Two of the Gang of Four, including a 44-year-old senior officer with a rank of brigadier, remain in custody while two others have been released. The viral images provoked a storm of condemnation across France this weekend and propelled as many as 500,000 people into the streets with demonstrations in dozens of cities. Protesters marched through the streets, setting light to cars, damaging buildings, and clashing with police, of whom a reported 98 were injured nationwide. Many of Paris' iconic boulevards resembled a war zone, as thousands of demonstrators pitched battle with lines of police in riot gear. President Macron said he was very shocked by the footage of the police attack on Zecler, yet continues to be a driving force behind new security law, under which many have noted that the images might never have come to light, given as they essentially identify the Parisian officers and clearly undermine their integrity or authority. Without the footage, it is possible that Zecler would have been facing prosecution himself. Although the bill and the protests against it are dominating French politics, the story has been covered sparsely in the American corporate press, with no coverage whatsoever in MSNBC, CBS News, or CNBC. Fox News, meanwhile, reprinted one Associated Press article featuring an egregious, uncorrected error in its sub headline, asserting that protesters were shooting tear gas at themselves. While foreign desks have been seriously cut in recent years, huge demonstrations in central Paris should not have been too difficult to cover. Lebanese political commentator Sarah Abdullah suggested that if the rallies had been happening in countries antagonistic to the United States, they would have been front-page news. The U.S. Secretary of State is yet to comment on the events in France, suggesting that they are not at the front and center of his thoughts. President Macron came to power in 2017, winning in the final round of the election against far-right challenger Marine Le Pen. A strong believer in neoliberalism and an admirer of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, he has insisted that France must not merely be reformed, but transformed, and has attempted to radically alter the shape of French society, away from a social democratic model to one more resembling the United States of America. Almost immediately after gaining the presidency, however, his average approval rating tumbled and has not risen above 40% since. Indeed, the 42-year-old former investment banker has faced almost constant resistance to his agenda from the general public. His attempts to increase the cost of fuel in 2018 sparked the Yellow Vest movement across France. Meanwhile, his plans to raise the age of retirement and reform France's pension system was met with months-long general strike that paralyzed France last winter. Despite losing over 50,000 people to the coronavirus pandemic, he has seen his popularity increase this year due to the government's financial response to the virus, which included aid to small businesses and paying employees to stay home.